These are the three things you should know about today. The U.S. has literally run out of weapons to give to Ukraine. Mr. Putin is going to arrive in Alaska with rather sizable negotiating advantages, and I'm going to tell you what they are. Mr. Trump, meanwhile, is reeling from new Epstein and Israel backlashes, and he seems to be treating his talks with Mr. Putin like it's just another real estate deal. It's not. It's not. This is the Sanchez effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I want to start by looking ahead toward the Great Alaska Summit, or maybe it's not so great, right? Here's how analysts are describing this meeting. They say, if this were a poker game, Mr. Putin's first hand is a full house, while Mr. Trump barely has a pair of sixes. Think of it this way. The U.S. has thrown every conceivable conventional weapon in its arsenal at Russia. It has spent more than $300 billion to defeat or try and weaken Russia. And in the process, instead, it has run out of missiles, drones, and air defense systems that it can spare without obviously dangerously depleting its own needs, right? Its own stocks. And here's what's even worse, right? Experts say Ukraine will have to wait 7 years or so for new Patriot defense systems, because that's how long it's going to take for the U.S. to restock its own reserves. Meanwhile, the Russian military's weapons capacity has actually increased. Its army recruitment and volunteer effort never been higher. Its military is advancing relentlessly, taking more and more territory each and every day. And while that is happening, Ukraine seems to be running out of soldiers, giving ground, and watching its people take to the streets to protest both the war and government corruption. So let me ask you, right? If this were you, which side of the negotiating table would you rather be on? Still, I gotta say this. He's my president. Mr. Trump deserves to be given some credit here. Clearly, he has, I get it, doesn't have a thorough understanding of the culture or the history of this conflict, nor does he seem to understand the genesis of Russia's complaints or even what its term points are. But he is doing something that, look, again, give him props. This hasn't happened since 2015. That was the last time that Mr. Putin visited the United States. Here he is. It was during the Obama years. And he was there to attend a UN session. And since then, relations between the two nuclear superpowers have gone from bad to worse. Think about this. A year ago, under the Biden regime, and I don't use that word lightly, given Mr. Biden's condition at the time, I mean the word regime, the Russian president, he would have been arrested. He would have been arrested. Putin would have been arrested if he would have stepped foot on U.S. soil under Biden. Now, he's there, and he's about to sit down with the U.S. president. Look, again, that in and of itself is progress. However, it's not enough. It's not enough. You see, for the meeting to be successful, Mr. Trump needs to understand what Russia wants. And it appears that he doesn't understand that. In fact, Mr. Trump seems to think that he's settling some type of territorial dispute. He calls it a land swap.
And there'll be some swapping. There'll be some changes in land. And the word that they will use is, they make changes. We're going to change the lines, the battle lines. Russia's occupied a big portion of Ukraine. They've occupied some very prime territory. We're going to try and get some of that territory back for Ukraine. But they've taken some very prime territory. They've taken largely ocean, in real estate, we call it oceanfront property. That's always the most valuable property.
Oceanfront property. No, Mr. President. Russia is not looking for oceanfront property. It's not looking for a land swap. This is not a real estate deal. What Russia has said from the very beginning, and we'll say this again, what Russia has said from the very beginning is It wants security. That's all. It wants guarantees against NATO's expansion, against NATO's military aggression, political interference, and constant mendacities, all things that have been proven. It does not want more land. What it wants is neutral neighbors. Neutral. And it wants to stop being played by NATO. That's it. Then there's this, the Zelensky matter.
I was a little bothered by the fact that Zelensky was saying, well, I have to get constitutional approval. I mean, he's got approval to go into war and kill everybody, but he needs approval to do a land swap, because there'll be some land swapping going on. I know that through Russia and through conversations with everybody.
A lot of land swapping going on, right? Zelensky, by the way, is banking on European support. He's turning down the entire proposal on the table so far from Trump. And he's also threatening to make a last-minute appearance at the summit, like Superman or something. His comportment, interestingly, up to now, is not sitting well with either Mr. Putin or Mr. Trump. But Mr. Trump has bigger problems. He has bigger problems than Zelensky, let's be honest. The president needs a win here. He needs a big win, because he's suffering huge losses at home. His friendship with a notorious child molester seems to play like if it were a movie on a loop every day these days in America, on news shows and everywhere else, like this.
Trump says he's known Epstein since the late 80s, and pictures from the 90s show the president with Maxwell, who became Epstein's girlfriend.
They were neighbors in Palm Beach. At one point, Epstein was a member at Mar-a-Lago.
It's party time at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago, and among the guests, Jeffrey Epstein. Trump and Epstein can be seen ogling the cheerleaders. Trump points one of them out and says, "She's hot." Then he says something in Epstein's ear that has the financier doubled up in laughter.
And here's what's worse. Mr. Trump is now suddenly being uncharacteristically nice to the only person, oh, what a coincidence, right? The only person who knows exactly what happened between him and Epstein. And the way Mr. Trump is acting here seems, well, suspicious. Ghislaine Maxwell is in jail. She's in jail for recruiting and grooming young girls for Mr. Epstein and others, who he then introduced them to. Yet Mr. Trump is considering giving her a pardon, letting her out. And watch the way the president, who's never short on attacking people, obviously, discusses here the conviction for this sex trafficker.
I haven't really been following it too much. I just wish her well, frankly. I've met her numerous times over the years, especially since I lived in Palm Beach, and I guess they lived in Palm Beach. But I wish her well, whatever it is.
He wishes her well? When have you ever heard the president say that about anybody? Especially people in that situation. So Trump's other big problem is also plain and simple: Israel. Americans are now realizing the cost of supporting this tiny nation, and they're angry. They're angry at the president for allowing the prime minister to walk into the United States and just Bigfoot his administration. Even Mr. Trump's biggest supporter in Congress, she's now turned against both. Listen.
USAID typically accounts for 15 to 20% of Israel's defense budget, even though Israel, nuclear-armed Israel, has universal health care for their citizens and subsidized college for their citizens. They're able to provide that. However, here in America, we're $37 trillion in debt. My amendment to strike $500 million in foreign aid will ensure an America first Department of Defense, and that is exactly what we need and we haven't had for a very long time.
Yeah, she's saying cut the funding for Israel. And she's angry at the president for getting so close to them and backing them. By the way, there's still another loss the president has recently suffered. And this one the whole world saw, and it's directly related to the war in Ukraine. You see, in an effort to harm Russia's economy even further, Mr. Trump went after one of Russia's top trading partners, threatening India with tariffs of 50% if they don't stop buying Russian oil. India brushed it off, essentially telling the United States president, sorry, Mr. President, but you don't get to tell us who we can or we can't buy oil from. Ouch. Again, advantage Putin. So, when we come back, I am going to be joined by India's ambassador to discuss Russia, to discuss why India chose to cut its own course and deflect interference in its affairs from the United States. Vinay Kumar, India's ambassador to Russia, will be good enough to join me. He'll be sitting right here next to me, and we're going to have this conversation about what's going on between relations with the U.S., India, Russia, India, and a lot of other things. Stay with us. We're going to be right back. Hey, welcome back to The Sanchez Effect. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know, one of the great things that we are able to do here, that I am able to do here, Mr. Ambassador, is when I worked at CNN and when I worked at Fox and when I worked at NBC in the United States, we don't spend a lot of time doing interviews with world or global newsmakers. We just don't. And since we've been doing this show, I've been doing this show here, it is so wonderful to be able to invite dignitaries like yourself, who are the people who make the important decisions around the world for all the different countries in the world, from Russia, China, hopefully soon even the United States, so we can discuss some of these big issues. So with that said, and I wanted you to hear that because I think it shows my appreciation as a journalist for someone like you to take the time to come down, sit here with us and explain some of your country's points of view on these very important issues. And with that, let me introduce to you Vinay Kumar. His Excellency is the Indian ambassador to Russia, to talk about some of the things that have suddenly put India right smack in the middle of the news. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for being here.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the question of what happened recently when the United States of America chose to threaten India with a 50% tariff for being friends with Russia and for buying oil from Russia. And the Indian reaction surprised some people because it was seemingly very stern. What would you say about that reaction from both the United States and from India?
Well, Rick, I can talk about India. Our reaction has been very measured. India decides on its trade ties with different countries in its own national interest, just as every other country would do.
Of course.
And in this case of crude imports from Russia, it is something that has brought about stability in global oil market. Government's commitment is to protect the interest of 1.4 billion people of India. So there are many other countries which are trading with Russia, including the countries which have imposed sanctions. And so we do not think that the decision of additional tariff is correct.
It sounds like what you're saying is, and with all due respect, it makes a lot of sense to me. What you're saying is, what we are doing is looking out for the interests of the people of India. We are going to get the best deal possible to serve our people. That's a pretty good answer. That makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
Who's going to argue with that?
Well, that's the reason we think that the U.S. decision is actually unjust.
Yeah.
Unfair and unreasonable.
Because the alternative of that, let's suppose we start with that. What you're saying is, look, Rick, we want to make sure we get the best deal for our people. We've got a lot of people, 1.4 billion people, right? The alternative of that is we're not going to get the best deal for our people. We're going to do something which is not such a good deal so that somebody else can be happy with us. That's the alternative. And that doesn't sound like a good plan either, does it?
Well, absolutely. We, of course, want common well-being of everybody. Yeah. And so we see that all the countries are acting accordingly, and so does India.
You know, it's funny because the United States started putting sanctions on Russia, then the whole war broke out with Ukraine. And through all of that, it seems like the relationship between Russia and India, which I think was always fair to good, right, has changed. Some would say it's gotten better. It's gotten closer. Like, the Russia and India are allies these days, in some ways as a result of all the things that have gone and all the things that have happened back and forth. How would you describe India-Russia relations today?
Well, India and Russia share what we call a special and a strategic, privileged strategic partnership for more than 2.5 decades.
Huh. And we two and a half decades, 25 years.
25 years.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yes. Mm. And we have been cooperating across various sectors of our national endeavors, be it for energy security in the form of atomic energy, education, science and technology, defense, of course. Trade has been an important area. So under our various agreements that we have signed, we have annual exchange of the visits of the leaders, President of Russia and Prime Minister of, mm-hmm. of India. And today we have a very vibrant Indian community in Russia. Also, almost
I see them. Yeah, yeah.
Almost 50,000-60,000 Indian students.
And thank God, by the way, because the restaurants, the Indian restaurants, are here now and blossoming. And I happen to think that it's the best food in the world. But continue.
Yes, so I have tens of thousands of Indian students studying in Russian academic institutions. And then we have very vibrant cultural cooperation. Just last month, we had 9 days of festival in which almost 150,000 people visited in Manizhnaya Ploshad.
So then what you're saying is, look, this makes sense, Rick. I mean, we've had great relations for 25 years. Suddenly Russia finds itself in a situation where it's got all this oil and Europe doesn't want it, or the United States is not letting Europe have it. They call us and they say, we've got oil, you want to do a deal? And we Indians say, sure, let's do a deal. Makes sense. Nothing weird about that, right? That's pretty much what happened.
Well, absolutely. The commercial considerations and energy security interest of the people of India.
Yeah, yeah. How would you... Let's talk a little bit about how this whole thing happened, right? So Russia's had a tough time of it in terms of the way it's been treated by the West. And the West has always been mad at Russia. I don't know why. Ever since Russia, you know, the Soviet collapse, it just seems like the West has just poured it on Russia. Sanctions, lambasting them, looking for regime change in Russia. That's the exact word that Mr. Biden used. He wanted regime change. These are strong things for governments to do against other countries. How would you assess, you're the ambassador to Russia, how would you assess the way Russia has managed itself during this pressure, if you want to call it, or some of these actions that have been taken by the West? How would you characterize it?
You know, we come from a culture in which we put a lot of emphasis on human beings, humanity as a race. And our approach is always cooperation, mm-hmm. Common well-being of the entire race.
Yeah.
And we have very ancient concept of Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam. The whole earth is one family. And in that family, we can have differences, but we always resolve them by cooperation.
Yeah.
And I think the problems that we face as humanity warrant us to cooperate, talk to each other, understand each other's concern, and move in a collaborative manner to fulfill the maximum benefits for the entire race,
Where
humanity.
You know,
I am nobody to, comment on individual policies. I can only talk about how India addresses the vision that we have of one earth, one people, one family, to promote the collaborative international relations.
I think, to a certain extent, that my opinion, and you'll pardon me for saying this, what you just said kind of fits the way Russia has tried to manifest itself while it was having slings and arrows thrown at it. I haven't seen Russia come out and say horrible things about everybody else, or they've kind of taken a beating, kind of, but yet they've kind of held their position. I would almost argue they've shown the temperament of India, because India's always known for being moderate, for being, Mr. Modi's always like in the middle. He doesn't go too far this way or too far that way. And, you know, it seems to me, and it's difficult, and I know I'm assessing it, that Russia has tried to manifest that type of composure. Do you agree, disagree?
So it is not for nothing that India and Russia have had this close cooperation for last so many decades. There is communication, there is understanding, there is appreciation of the mutual interest. Mm-hmm. And so there you go.
You know, given the West has been less than honest in the past with Russia, you know, let's face it, there's been a lot of things that have happened as we go into this. Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump are about to sit down in Alaska. And by the way, credit to Mr. Trump. He deserves credit, because if this had happened a year ago, Mr. Putin would have been arrested when he arrived in the United States. Mr. Biden said, if he comes here, we'll arrest him. I mean, that's how horrible the relationship was between the United States and Russia at the time. But now, good for Mr. Trump for inviting Mr. Putin to go to Alaska, U.S. territory, where they will sit and try and come up with some kind of solution. Still, given the things that have happened in the past, I know Mr. Putin probably has to be very wary. What advice would you give to the president of Russia as he goes to sit down to try and figure this this Ukraine situation out with President Trump?
Rick, it is much above my pay grade to advise anybody, least of all the president of Russia. What I would say is that we endorse the decision for this meeting. And as Prime Minister Modi has always said, that this is not an era of war. We have always supported dialogue and diplomacy to resolve the current situation. And so we endorse it, and we stand ready to be of any assistance that we can be.
What is it about India that makes that? You and I had a chance to talk just a little while ago before we started this interview. I should let our viewers know we had a chance to chat on a couple of things, including football and stuff and food. So, but more importantly, I have a lot of Indian friends in the United States, my doctor, my friend, golf partners. And one of the things I realize about India, and one of the things that I've learned from them, is, yes, India has this personality makeup as a country and its people, where they're thinkers, they're big thinkers. They don't become rash, they don't overact. I'm watching you right now, even your demeanor is like, you're so tranquil, much more than I am as a Cuban, by the way, so, or as an American. What is it about the past of India, the culture of India, that makes you examine things as a whole? Even the advice you're giving now to President Putin, the way you describe world relations, it seems peaceful, thought out. Where does that come from?
Well, you know, this land has always been a land of seers and rishis and thinkers. We have realized, our forefathers realized and passed on to us, is that we are one earth. There is one life. There are not many lives. And since it is one life, whatever happens in one part of it affects the other. Mm. And hence, an integration is required. Just like, you know, my legs, my hands, my mouth, my eyes, all have to be functioning in an integrated manner for me to work to my optimum. Similarly, all parts of the universe, but all parts of this earth, has to be in harmony with each other. Hmm. And our forefathers, our seers, our rishis have shared certain ways and means of reaching that harmony. That's yoga is one part of it, which is at the physical level, it enables you to live a healthy life, but also mental and levels above that. When you integrate all of it, the certain fulfillment comes. Ayurveda, for when you become ill health, we are not talking of just addressing the symptoms, but going deeper and addressing the causes which have caused that this imbalance in the system. So, we all feel it. We all know it. Only that we all don't practice it. Mm-hmm. And the world as it is moving, the technological growth, empowerment of common man and woman that is taking place today, that will certainly make them more, inquisitive, more interested in this kind of philosophy and practices, which gives them individual fulfillment. And that's the reason you see in all parts of the globe, but here in Russia, tremendous interest in Ayurveda and yoga and other forms of this wisdom that has come from our forefathers today. A large number of people, when we do yoga events, just International Day of Yoga that we did on 21st of June, thousands of people in so many cities. And it has become more and more people are adopting it as a way of life and benefiting from it.
And you know what's fascinating about, as I hear you say that, my friends who I, have shared great times with here and in the United States, who happen to be Indian, have always told me as well that one of the things that frustrates them is that too many people around the world, especially in the West, see India as a country that only began being a country, after the British colonization, right? That everything is about that period, and they don't know that there was another India. There was an India that goes back thousands and thousands of years, and that's where a lot of the things that you're talking about actually started, pre-Gandhi, not just post-Gandhi, right?
Absolutely. India is one of the oldest civilizations, and more importantly, one of the oldest living civilizations. So vast majority of Indian people worship, pray, have understanding of life, which originated thousands of years of back. So there is a continuity in our thought. Of course, in the tide of time, history, we have been rich, we have been poor. Now we are the most populous country, the third, on the way to become third largest economy, fastest growing economy. So we would have certainly a much better quality and a standard of life in the years ahead. But what has remained constant all through is this basic understanding of the people of India, of one life.
They're talking
one
about
one earth and one family.
They're talking about a $10 trillion economy for India, which is crazy. It's the fastest growing economy in the entire world right now. And, you know, again, as I hear you speak, I'm thinking, what an advantage that is for you, your culture, your history, and everything that makes you, and other Indians as well, Your Excellency, gives you a huge advantage as a diplomat. I mean, your job is diplomacy. It's seeking, finding truth, and finding common ground. Maybe all the diplomats in the world should be Indian, the way that you are explaining this, because I think it's really important. Does it frustrate you sometimes? I know. I'm going to ask this question, because it just came to my mind. Does it frustrate you sometimes when you watch other world leaders or perhaps even other diplomats not take those things into account and you see them being bombastic or acting out or not thinking through things?
Well, I would say that we promote these values. We make all our efforts that the colleagues and other partners that we are talking with understand that we not only have to maximize our individual interest, but also keep an eye on towards the larger interest, peace, stability, prosperity, cooperation across the globe. We have a positive agenda. And so we do not give in to short-term, immediate problems and get frustrated. No, we keep at it. Because we have that long-term vision, what we can be.
Yeah.
And so we always move towards, endeavor to progress towards that.
Well, when I said bombastic and loud and angry, I didn't have, I was possibly thinking of one person, and I'm not going to say his name, but his initials are Donald Trump. just for the record, one wonders sometimes if, maybe we could send him somewhere to learn how to be more at peace with himself so he can work through some of these things. But we are with where we are. And again, look, I think I am appreciative. I'm sure you are appreciative. And I think the world is appreciative of the fact that this man, who oftentimes acts in the ways that he does, and anybody can describe it however they want, nonetheless, he's the one who's bringing himself and the Russian president together for a conversation. And that should be applauded and appreciated. No question.
As the world's oldest and largest democracies, the people elect the leaders. And so all elected leaders, from our perspective, are partners that we need to work with.
Yeah.
And as I was mentioning, so far as we are concerned about this forthcoming meeting, we not only endorse it, but we stand ready to be of any support in any manner that we can be.
Well said. Well said. So now we have President Putin, who's scheduled, by the way, to have bilateral talks. He's going to be attending a bilateral summit with Prime Minister Modi later this year, I believe. I don't have the exact date. That's important. Given what's going on in the world today, this sudden relationship has, you mentioned, it's been going on for 25 years, but it really seems to have blossomed more recently. It seems to be a very important relationship now. What do you think are the key discussion points in this important bilateral meeting between India and Russia?
I was mentioning, we have this tradition of annual summits between the two leaders. Mm. And last year, Prime Minister Modi visited Moscow in July for that annual summit. He, of course, paid a second visit in October for BRICS summit. This year, President Putin will be visiting India. I would not like to prejudge what they would talk. I cannot prejudge also.
Right.
I can certainly say that we have a very rich agenda of bilateral cooperation in multiple fields. And the leaders, apart from discussing those bilateral issues of cooperation, how to enhance trade and economic ties, would also exchange views on the global issues which are of great interest for both the countries. I can tell you also that there is a definite very positive chemistry between the two leaders.
Is there?
They have met many times. They keep regularly speaking on phone with each other. And as a matter of fact, they just had conversation last week on Friday.
I see that, body language. Whenever they're together, and I don't know if we have the pictures, but there's video of them that I've watched a million times. And now that you say that, it makes me think, every time I see Mr. Putin and Mr. Modi on camera together, their body language seems to give off this very, very positive, friendly vibe. And you're right. That I don't think that's fake.
It can't be. They are both very genuine people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's genuine.
Yes, absolutely.
And you can confirm these guys like each other.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's talk BRICS. BRICS is a phenomenon. I mean, it's just an absolute phenomenon. BRICS is becoming one of the, the lubricant that seems to be oiling the world so that it can better find itself, right? I've never seen anything like this. And India is right smack in the middle of BRICS, in a very unique position almost, because while some of the country in BRICS kind of consider themselves non-Western nations or even in many ways antagonistic toward the West at times, only because the West sometimes is antagonistic toward them, India's kind of in the middle of all of this. India doesn't go too far here, too far there, but it's very comfortable in BRICS. What would your comment be about India's role in BRICS, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, India is the original founding member of BRICS. This is an organization to promote economic cooperation, to promote the interests of the global South. And it has a lot of positive agenda for cooperation among its own members. Mm-hmm. One of very concrete achievements of BRICS is the New Development Bank, which has funded a large number of development and infrastructure projects in a number of countries, not only those which are member, but also some others which have chosen to join that. So India is an original founding member of BRICS, and it is no wonder that India plays a very important role in its positive agenda.
BRICS is... Do you share my opinion that BRICS is really coming on? We used to talk about the G7, and we used to talk about all these other organizations that were mostly European and very Western, but it almost seems like BRICS is now the most popular group in the class, right? Everybody wants to join BRICS. Everybody talks about BRICS. BRICS is kind of making its own way in such a way so that now, even though Western countries have long ignored it, I know if I'm American, if you walk down the streets of America and you ask people in America, what's BRICS? They'll tell you it's something you use to make a house. They don't even know because the media doesn't talk about BRICS. But in the rest of the world, BRICS is really a comer. I think it's a differentiator in many ways. It's an equalizer, no?
Well, we see BRICS as an important organization for economic cooperation among its members. Obviously, it has certain weight in the international economic affairs simply because the most populous members, many of the developing countries, technologically advanced societies like Russia, they all are member of it. And next year, in 2026, India is going to be the president of BRICS, and our prime minister has already announced that we are going to have a program, a set of cooperation items, which will reform BRICS into even a stronger organization, as he said. It will be building of resilience and innovation for cooperation and sustainability, which will promote cooperation among its members and also become a stronger voice of global South in the international arena. Just as 3 years back, when India chaired G20, we had several Voice of Global South summits. And African Union became a member of G20 during India's chairmanship. Next year in BRICS, we also would work similarly to give greater voice to the Global South.
I look forward to being there. And it would be an absolute honor, one of the honors of my life, if I have a chance to sit down and talk or meet, or even if I'm lucky enough to interview Mr. Modi. That would be a fantastic opportunity for me. So expect me to reach out to you to try and see if I can make that happen, Your
Welcome.
Excellency. By the way, you were just mentioning something that I think is very, very important. When you were talking about BRICS, the first thing that you immediately started talking about is the financial aspect of it, the international monetary financial cooperation between these countries. So it would bemoan me if I didn't ask you, since you said that, something which is also a phenomenon which is taking place in the world right now, and that is de-dollarization is maybe too big of a word, but there is an emphasis on perhaps putting less value on just one currency, the dollar, which has primacy as currency around the world, as you and all of our viewers know, and maybe making currency more fair, perhaps even more expansive, maybe not choosing just one currency, but using other currencies. This seems to be kind of the backstory behind BRICS. Do you see that as a possibility? How much importance do you give that conversation?
You know, political scientists have, of course, a particular way of looking at it.
Yeah.
But as I was mentioning to you, we have a positive agenda in BRICS. We want to strengthen our national economies. We want to do that in a cooperative framework of a large number of countries that are members of BRICS and many others which are otherwise partner of New Development Bank or the individual BRICS members. The program in BRICS is not against something, it's for itself. Mm-hmm. So more and more trade settlements are being done in the national currencies of the BRICS member states.
Mm.
And that is helping us in our economic and trade investment relations with each other on a bilateral basis.
Mm.
And that's what at present is on the agenda.
You know, it's funny you say that because I'm thinking through what you just said and I'm looking at the world as it is today, and that kind of makes some sense already, even without de-dollarization. Because let's suppose tomorrow, country X, let's say Great Britain, or let's say, not that India's ever had problems with Great Britain, but wink. Let's suppose tomorrow a country decides that it's going to go after and punish India, punish its currency, punish it financially. What you've just described is a situation where India could say, okay, you guys are not going to work with us. We're going to work with Team B or Team C or Team D. We're going to work with other countries, and we're going to develop financial relationships so that we can work through your omission, work through the fact that we don't trade with you, we'll trade with them, which is kind of what BRICS is kind of bringing about. It's almost like creating a situation where one country cannot Bigfoot the rest of the countries. Did I say that right?
Well, that's what I have been talking, cooperation among the countries as the entire committee of nations. If we talk about India, then we are talking about almost 16, 17% of humanity.
Hmm.
We are talking of
16 or 17% of humanity.
Yes.
In other words, the population of the Earth.
You know, 1.4 billion people we are talking about.
I never thought of it those ways. That's a lot of people, Your Excellency.
We are talking of the fourth largest economy in nominal terms, which is the fastest growing and on the way to become the third largest.
Yeah.
Countries will cooperate with us for our strength, for what India is doing in the world and what benefits and prospects they have with cooperation. So we will be moving forward on all our international interactions with a positive agenda for common benefit.
Mm.
And then keep dealing with the issues that keep arising, which I guess they do sometimes.
Yeah, no, right. Like my first question to you was about suddenly Donald Trump saying that he's going to punish your country, and India just smiled and looked at Mr. Trump and said, I'm sorry, Mr. President, but you don't get to tell us who we do business with, which seemed to be, simply put, your response. It wasn't mean, it wasn't angry, it was just, we make our own decisions.
But, you know, most countries, or all countries do that.
Yeah, but a lot of countries freak out. I mean, oh my God, the United States of America, what do you want, sir? Yes, tell me what you want me to do. India did not curl and cotter under that pressure, it seemed, which was, some people were surprised. Not me, but some people were surprised.
Well, for me, it was just what it is. We are not a new lot of people.
We people.
No, no, not the country is new. Yeah. And certainly civilization is, as I was telling, the oldest living civilization on this planet.
Yeah, no, there's an expression in the United States. We say, I wasn't born in a barn and I wasn't born last night. Right. I've been around. I've got experience. I know what I'm doing. So don't count me out just yet. By the way, RT is set to expand its presence in India. And the funny thing, there seems to be a symbiotic relationship between maybe what I do, what we do, what RT has been able to accomplish in India. And it seems to be very well received. People in India like the messaging, the way that RT delivers the news and the conversations that take place in RT, which is interesting because, you know, I've said this before. I don't know if you've heard me say this, Mr. Ambassador, but I now have a show here. I used to have a show on CNN. I used to have a show. I'm sure you looked me up or Googled me. I had a show on NBC, on Fox, on CNN, on Univision, and I've worked even in the BBC. So I have never worked in a place where I find more independence, journalistic independence, the ability to control my own narrative, the ability to have questions like you and I are having right now, which are just smart, intelligent conversations between two people, where in many of those places in the United States, for example, I found, with all due respect, that they did not give me this freedom, that in many ways they tried to control what I could and couldn't say or could, or what I could talk about. So I personally am very proud to be working here and doing what I'm doing. I have found that the reception in India has been very good, despite the fact that RT is banned in the United States and criticized heavily in the Western world. What do you make of those conflictive stakes? India seems to like RT and has embraced RT and its messaging. The West has banned and pushed back RT. What do you make of
it? You know, free flow of information, certainly with due respect for the public morality, harmony, safety and national security. Mm-hmm. With due consideration for this, having difference of opinions is very normal to us. We are not a society with a particular brand of philosophy or a particular view of life. Like our forefathers have said that though the truth is one, all the saints and all the seers speak of it differently. Having diversity of views is just what is very normal thing in India.
It's part of the culture.
Part of the culture. You don't worship in the same way. You don't have to do any particular thing in one particular way. Like from being very ritualistic to being atheist, it is all part of our culture.
Yeah.
So, so far as reception of Russian Indian relations in Indian public is very positive. Russia is viewed as a friendly country, as a country which over the last 7-8 decades has sought to understand India, to cooperate with India, and given our colonial experience, foreign rule for period. Russia is even seen more friendly, actually. I am happy that RT is present in Indian market, and as you say, people like it. So good for us.
You just made me think of somebody. When I first went away to college, I was just a young kid. My parents were poor. We didn't have any money. And I got a football scholarship. So because I played football very well, I was going to get to go to school for free. I went to a place called Morehead State in Minnesota, North Dakota. I mean, you think Siberia is cold. This place is really very cold place. And I met a young Indian student who had just arrived in the country as well. His name was Prakash Nayak. I'll never forget him. Loved him. We became great friends. Big thinker. And I remember he said to me, He said, you know the problem with you Americans? I said, no, please, tell me. What's the... You guys need to be more honest about who you really are. For example, you've never admitted that you lost the war in Vietnam. And I turn on the TV and you guys act like it was just a story, a movie, but you just should say, okay, we lost. It's okay. And it's funny because I think of my country, which is a great country. I love America. America's got great people, and it was built on a wonderful, great system some 200 years ago where people got together and said they would create a system for the people and by the people. However, it tends to want to go around the world telling everybody how it is a democracy and they are not. And they are for free speech, but free speech doesn't exist in other places. And lately, I'll tell you, Mr. Ambassador, as an American, it's like, what happened? We lately, as Americans, are the ones who aren't really promoting free speech. I see more free speech in other places, unfortunately, or fortunately, maybe, I should say. So I think in many ways, like my friend Prakash, it's very possible that you and other people from India have an appreciation for some of the stories that are being told in not just RT, but independent media and so many podcasts out there where they challenge the status quo. And because India went through this colonial past, which was pretty tough, I think it appreciates people who challenge the status quo. Is that a good way to explain it?
Well, as I said, we welcome diversity of opinions, diversity of thoughts.
Yeah, yeah.
But depending on where we are at a particular time and place, where how we see ourselves in the pecking order, we may talk differently. But the fact remains that since we have this deep-rooted realization of one earth, one family, we always seek to work in cooperation rather than domination or competition or destruction of anything that we don't like.
Say that again. One what? One family?
One earth, one family.
One family. That's gorgeous. That's a great way of... that's a great way of looking at the world. And
yes.
And it seems like the kind of thinking that can bring us closer together. And, well, you're a diplomat, and you do it well, and you represent your point of view well, and you represent your country well. And I really want to thank you.
Thank you for taking the time.
No, this has been a delightful conversation, and I think it's important for us to have these conversations so that we can better understand ourselves and become a better, more peaceful world.
Absolutely.
Which is, in many ways, what the goal of a diplomat should be, and the goal of a journalist should be as well.
All of us.
And that's how I see it. Thank you again, sir. Vinay Kumar, His Excellency, Indian Ambassador to Russia. And that's it from us. Thank you so much for being with us. Hey, check out my podcast if you get a chance. It's called Journalistically Speaking. And lately, people from all over the world, especially India, have been tuning in and subscribing, and I'm so thankful that you're doing so. I'll do my best to try and continue to meet your expectations. I'm also on X. You can find me there on Rick Sanchez TV, and we can have a chat. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll be looking for you next time.